you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Welcome back to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Well, it was after midnight on March 3rd, 1992, when a Lakeview Terrace plumber was woken up by a commotion outside of his apartment building. And he stepped out onto his balcony and he used his brand new Sony camcorder to record several LAPD officers viciously beating a black man. And that video showed Rodney King on the ground, defenseless, the LAPD kicking and striking him, some using their batons like baseball bats. And that image eventually reached millions of viewers around the world and ignited a national conversation about police violence and eventually led to the explosive Los Angeles uprising when those officers were acquitted the following year. Today is the 30th anniversary of the Rodney King beating, and it is nearly 9 months since a Minneapolis police officer pinned George Floyd to the ground and slowly choked him to death. So we wanted to convene a conversation about images of police brutality and how they lead to change or don't. Jody Armour is with me, professor of law at USC, and also joining our conversation is Brenda Stevenson, professor of history and African American studies at UCLA. And Jody, I want to start with you. This question has become somewhat cliche, but I think it helps clarify and brings out personal stories when one asks, do you remember where you were when you first saw the Rodney King beating and how it impacted you?
Yeah, Libby, I can remember the day, the time, and the weather. It was one of those kinds of moments because I think a lot of Americans said that on 2016, in November 8th, I think it was, when Donald Trump was elected, that they were shocked that this is us, this is America. It was one of those moments for them. Well, that Rodney King beating was one of those moments for me. I was thinking, this is America, this is us. We've heard about this before, but to have the actual ocular proof, the smoking gun evidence before us, and then not only to have that shared experience of seeing that brutality, but to then later, I'm sure we're going to talk about, have a jury say that we shouldn't believe our lying eyes, then gaslight, black folk, and tell us that there's nothing there that we should be too upset about and view as excessive. So that's what I remember, just the moment of reckoning with where I am and who we are as Americans.
And that video went out a few days later, about 4 days later. So March 3rd being the incidence of the beating, and it got out to local TV and national television a few days after that. Brenda Stevenson with UCLA, same question to you. Where were you, and do you remember how it impacted you?
Yes, I do. Actually, I had just moved to Los Angeles, and I had lived my entire life on the East Coast and the South. And so I thought, that Los Angeles was going to be something different in terms of the racialized landscape. And indeed, when I saw that video, I knew that it was not any different. I mean, LA had this big national and global hype as the most diverse city in the country and, very laid back and all of that glitzy, et cetera, a place of opportunity, as California is often thought of, and Los Angeles in particular. And so I was really shocked and frightened by the images that I saw from the Halliday tape. It was, it really did re-center my sense of what it was to be in Los Angeles.
Jody, there are some really indelible images in the history of injustice and violence in America against Black people. But this, I think, was the first video, at least citizen-recorded video, that went viral before the internet was widespread. But I think back to images in the history of the civil rights struggle. One would be Emmett Till's open casket, which his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, orchestrated, really, because She wanted his body returned from Mississippi to Chicago because she knew the country had to see the image of her 14-year-old son's body to understand the depths of evils of racism in the country. Why, Professor Armour, do you think it historically has taken something like this, a newspaper or magazine photo of just something so horrific, to jolt mostly white people awake to the brutality that the United States has and does visit on black people?
Yeah, there's something, you know, really powerful about witnessing, bearing witness, visually seeing, these images. And I understand that there are those who are critical of our sharing these images on social media and elsewhere. They'll refer to it as trauma porn, or, you know, turning black pain into porn, into a voyeuristic exercise for many people. And I understand that concern and that downside to it. On the other hand, as you pointed out, Emmett Till, that was a deliberate decision by his mother to open up that casket so that we had to look at and confront the consequences of hatred, racial hatred, and viscerally connect with that. And, you know, that procession of hashtags that made up the Black Lives Matter movement and culminated in the George Floyd protest, that 8 minutes and 46 seconds of George Floyd was, in one way, you could say, a trauma porn, but in another way, it woke up the conscience of many Americans and moved people to the streets and result in real change here in L.A. with the Gascon coming into office, Measure J, real transformative change at the ballot box.
Mm. Brenda Stevenson, you were just listening to Jody Armour, by the way, from USC. Brenda Stevenson, you wrote a book about something that happened not long after the Rodney King beating, and that was what happened at a liquor store to a 15-year-old girl, Latasha Harlins. Tell me about what happened to Latasha and why at the time, and even today, Latasha Harlins' name is not well known outside of Los Angeles.
Well, Latasha was killed on March 16th. So just, a few days after, several days, almost 2 weeks after the Rodney King beating. And that also was captured on a videotape. And that videotape also, was shown to the public. Well, you know, Latasha walked into a liquor store, grocery store on that morning, which was a Saturday morning, to buy a $2 bottle of orange juice, $1.79 bottle of orange juice to take home to her family. And she didn't get out alive. She got into an argument with she was accused by the store owner, Sungja Du, of stealing. And they got into a verbal argument and then a physical altercation. And as Latasha was turning to walk out of the store with the orange juice she had placed back onto the counter, she shot in the back of the head. And she dies there in that shop. And so it was sort of like a 1-2 punch. You had Rodney King, and then, almost 2 weeks later, you have Latasha Harlins, and both of it's captured on videotape, and both of it becomes a videotape that the world sees.
Hmm. And talk to me about the ways that contributed to the atmosphere in Los Angeles that then really boiled over after the verdict out of Ventura County the following year.
Well, the two cases were sort of in tandem with one another, with Latasha's case being taken care of in that fall, and Ms. Du being found guilty of voluntary manslaughter. The suggestion before the court by the probation officer was that she received the maximum sentence of 16 years because it didn't seem that she demonstrated any remorse for the crime. The judge in the case, however, decided that Ms. Du should not serve any jail time at all. And so then this case becomes another marker of injustice within the Black community and the perception of the Black community and the larger community as well, of injustice towards Black people. Now, Latasha was 15 years old. Rodney King was 25 years old. Latasha had the money in her hand, obviously was not going to, steal the juice. She was going to pay for it. Rodney King was found speeding and under the influence. Latasha was killed Rodney King was actually beaten beyond recognition, but it was still alive. And so in some ways for the Black community, particularly the community in South Los Angeles, where Latasha lived, this was an even more galling act of injustice. And recall also that the jury found the four defendants in the Rodney King beating case not to be guilty, and with the hung jury for Powell, of course. But with Latasha Hollins, the jury found Mrs. Duke guilty, and the recommendation was that she serve the maximum sentence. So this, in some ways, was even more galling to the Black community in terms of the lapses in the criminal justice system with regard to Black justice and Black victimization.
Because, again, she only received probation and community service and no jail time, despite that video and a child being shot in the back of the head. Jody Armour from USC, take us then, you know, the timeline between the video of Rodney King being beaten, Latasha Harlins being shot, and then we have next year the surprising and galling, I think the word galling is what Brenda Stevenson used, verdict out of Ventura County, and the reaction in Los Angeles is historic. I mean, it was huge.
The way the Chief Daryl Gates at the time characterized the urban conflagration that ensued was as an opportunity for hooligans just to go off. You know, it was characterized by many in L.A. as, you know, just hooligans venting, right? But if that were the explanation, Libby, you know, they had people had more than adequate or ample provocation to just go off when the airwaves were saturated with the videotape of Rodney King getting beaten. You remember in the early 90s, 91, 92 timeframe, you just had 24-hour cable news coming on. So you could turn on the TV any time of the day and night and see this, you know, really atrocious video of Rodney King getting beaten, and the people of L.A. did not go off under that provocation. They waited for justice, right? They waited for the criminal justice system to run its course, for the promise of equal justice to be made good on, and you only had the explosion in rioting when that promise of equal justice seemed so flagrantly flouted by that Simi Valley jury's acquittal of the officers for behavior that we all witnessed with our own eyes on video. And so it was a statement not just by the officers that they had, you know, they gave short shrift to Black life, but that this jury sitting as representatives of the community, you know, because that's the jury's function, right? We're representatives of the community. They're saying as collectively, we have no problem with what we saw in that video. The officers didn't do anything excessive. And that then, when the criminal justice system lost its moral credibility, lost its legitimacy in the eyes of many in the LA community, that's when you had the conflagration.
And just like today, I think about all the events leading up to Eric Garner and then, you know, other Black men who have been killed by police, even children, Trayvon Martin, you know, more recently, Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor, of course, her name was invoked so often and still is invoked in the wake of the George Floyd protests. It's there are things that build up over time. There are events that stay in people's minds. And this is not just a one-off incident. This is the culmination of so many injustices that have been witnessed. And with George Floyd, things crystallized. And of course, the video is atrocious. But Jody Armour, it feels in a similar way, obviously the results have been different, but in a similar way, that it was an eruption after so much buildup and so much anger from the injustices that are seen over and over again.
Yeah, and you know, what we saw with Rodney King was more of a moment. And what we saw with George Floyd was the culmination of a movement, right? Rodney King didn't result in any deep changes in the LAPD, for example. It isn't until you get till you get to 2000 that you get the consent decree from the Department of Justice with LAPD after the Rampart scandal, right, which was so atrocious that there had to be a consent decree. There wasn't, you know, really meaningful deep reforms after Rodney King. So it wasn't until you get to, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, Trayvon Martin, when he was killed, George Zimmerman's acquittal there, and then the building of that infrastructure, you know, that kept the movement going through Sandra Bland and Walter Scott and Philando Castile, so that you had really sinews of connection that remained there when the cameras went away in 2016. You still have Black Lives Matter every Wednesday going out in front of Jackie Lacey's office and maintaining that infrastructure, so that when George Floyd moment did come along, there was already, you know, these activists and the necessary, you know, social infrastructure to make it into a generational movement and generational upheaval that we saw over the summer in the streets. And all, so this was much more of a movement. Rodney King gave us a very important moment, but it wasn't tied into a broader movement like Floyd was.
Mm. And the goals also of the movement, talking about looking at the purse strings for police, the defund movement. Brenda Stevenson, you know, jumping off of what Jody Armour just said, locally, of course, we had incidents like Dijon Kizzy in Westmont and Andreas Guardado, both killed by the sheriff's department last year, and investigations going into what happened with those shootings. And I think that there is this new political and social movement that's really crystallized again, as Jody said, with Black Lives Matter and targeting certain offices. Now looking at the LAPPL, the Police Protective League, the police union, as sort of the next goal to try to break some of the power of police unions in Los Angeles. It's really a new day for, but after long years of work by Black Lives Matter, for these movements in Los Angeles.
Yes, most certainly. And also just remember that as well, with every event that occurs, the community becomes more and more aware of the injustice and the long-term impact that it has. And so this community then feeds into the Black Lives Matter movement as it becomes more organized, and the other, you know, aspects of that movement as well. It becomes more organized. They have more and more people across the generations that are invested in it, so that when you have something like George Floyd, people are ready to go. And it's now a global movement, not just a local or a national movement. And so this bodes well in terms of change that will have some kind of real impact.
I think it's interesting to see in some corners of activist corners, really the abandonment of the idea that simply changing regulations and laws surrounding the way that police can act in the community. Now it's really focused on reimagining public safety and changing the funding structures for law enforcement and focusing on community safety and these alternatives like mental health care and ways to respond to 911 calls that do not involve police and hopefully then do not devolve into violence. Jody Armour, talk to me about the focus on money and defunding rather than so much so the regulation and laws surrounding policing.
Yeah, it's been a learning process, right? Over the years, various reform efforts have been advanced, interventions, and people have said this will work, you know, implicit bias training, let's try that. Body cams, let's try that. Let's try, you know, community policing, de-escalation training. You had all that going on in Minneapolis and more. And George Floyd still happened, you know, right there with all of those interventions in place. And people are starting to recognize that, you know, implicit bias training isn't going to really get at something like, you know, in this Valentine's that just passed here in L.A., circulated in the LAPD ranks was a Valentine, a mock Valentine of George Floyd that said, "You take my breath away."
Yeah.
You know, that kind of, you know, that kind of callous indifference to, you know, the suffering of someone like a Floyd is not just something you're going to solve with some implicit bias training. And so what many more and more of the activists have recognized is if we're going to minimize the harm of police to stereotype communities, socially marginalized communities, rather than trying to take police who are essentially violence workers, you know, we give them guns with live ammunition, a stun gun, a billy club, mace, and handcuffs. They're essentially violence workers, and we want to minimize the contact that those violence workers have with stereotype communities because you cannot really control your unconscious biases. I did some early work in this area, Libby, and I was hopeful at first, but what we found is self-regulation of your implicit biases. It's not something you can really much do. So what you to minimize the harm from stereotypes to minority communities or stereotype communities, you want to minimize the contact with violence workers with the members of that community, which means unbundling the police, you know, getting them out of being street-level social workers and having them focus their energy on solving violence and violent crimes and not, you know, broken windows policing or, you know, stop and frisk on wheels, which is what we have with, pretext stops with cars.
Mm-hmm. That's Jody Armour, professor of law at USC. And Brenda Stevenson is also with me, professor of history and African American studies at UCLA. She's authored numerous books, including The Contested Murder of Latasha Harlins, Justice, Gender, and the Origins of LA Riots. Final thoughts, Professor Stevenson, first, on the 30th anniversary of the Rodney King beating and the context today as the struggle for justice continues and now is really moving in the area of defunding the police and reimagining public safety?
Well, I think that, you know, we've learned a lot about what should happen and how to go about it and I would like to say that it's just, this is good work in terms of the police, but also the criminal justice system is not just the police. It's also, and we've seen this with all these contested cases, it's the juries, it is the judges, the special prosecutors, all of those people are involved, invested, and they have an impact on the criminal justice system in our society. So certainly the police are who we come into contact with the most, but they are being really held up by and supported by these other entities within the criminal justice system. And so we also need to turn a very, very bright light onto what happens, you know, in cases of this kind of injustice, what happens with those people, how much impact they have, how that can be made to be more equitable as well. And I also wanna say that, you know, the commemoration of Black Lives Lost is also a part of the movement for justice. And I just wanna give a shout out to the Harlins family who have been working for the past 30 years and just had this beautiful mural of Latasha Harlins placed up as a public, a piece of public art that commemorates the loss of life. So in almost every way—
Oh, and where can we see that mural? Sorry, Brenda.
Sorry, it's at the Algin Sutton Recreation Center in South Los Angeles. And it's absolutely stunning, as well as the HBO film or the Netflix film, I'm sorry, that is a love letter to Latasha. And all of these things help. They all to change the, you know, the imagination and the commitment of the public to making certain that we have a sense of the humanity of Black people of color who are over and over and over again not given justice.
That's Brenda Stevenson with UCLA. And Jody Armour, your final thoughts on this topic as we reflect on the 30th anniversary of the Rodney King beating and the context of what's happening today and how what progress and what little progress we have made. And also, if you could plug your book, I just want to give you an opportunity to share with people your book as well.
Sure, absolutely. Libby, these are in some ways the best and worst of times. You know, we're looking at a lot of reason for real concern about the state of things, but there's something to celebrate also that has come out of kind of the Rodney King moments and then the procession of hashtags that made up the Black Lives Matter movement and resulted in the streets of LA roiling with protesters for 6 weeks in a row, all crying out for criminal justice reform. And what we saw was the I think should celebrate is the power, the efficacy of grassroots activism. That's what we saw, that it can really make a difference, that we really, you saw that those street protests translate into ballot box changes. You know, George Gascon came in as a progressive prosecutor in the largest prosecutor's office in the nation, over 1,200 DAs, and Measure J, which is essentially, you could call it a defund the police kind of measure, up to 10% of the county's budget, which can be up to $10 billion a year. So up to, say, $1 billion a year dedicated to incarceration alternative. Those are the voters at the ballot box responding to the grassroots activism of Black Lives Matter and their allies and making deep, serious changes. And that's something to celebrate, that from all of these urban crises that we're talking about.
And did you want to mention your book as well?
And my book tries to tackle a lot of these issues. It's In Asterisk GGA Theory, Race, Language, Unequal Justice, and the Law. And I try to help us grapple with the fact that we have otherized, demonized, monsterized Black people, inwardized them, and that has driven too much of our social policy, and we have to humanize if we're going to really make progress.
Jody Armour, professor of law at USC, and Brenda Stevenson, professor of history and African American studies at UCLA, convening for a conversation about the 30th anniversary of the Rodney King beating and the impact that the video that really was heard around the world, seen around the world, had on policing and America's understanding of violence against Black and brown bodies in the 90s and how the context has changed or not today. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle. I'm going to be back with an interesting conversation about the hurdle that is keeping many medical school graduates from becoming practicing physicians. Hear about that next, right here on Air Talk, back in a minute.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.